Good afternoon and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Every year about this time, for the past 3 years at least, our weather's gotten so strange that people start talking about it. And here at Hometown Alaska, we organize a show around Alaska weather and climate so the experts can explain what's happening and listeners can ask questions. This year, that warning call came early from one of our guests on the show today, climatologist Brian Bretschneider. It was December 29th when Brian sent me a Facebook message that said, "It might be time for another weird winter weather show." At the time, folks in Anchorage had had a snowless winter and ice-coated the city streets. People were out there skating. So we planned the show, and that day it snowed. Hence the title, Winter, Can We Catch Up? With all that fresh snow, maybe things aren't so bad. Well, this morning, the very day of the show, the top headline in the New York Times reads, 2015 was hottest year in historical record, scientists say. NASA and NOAA, who compile and analyze their data separately, both just released figures that show 2015 to be our warmest since 1880. British and Japanese scientists released similar information. So that news is the backdrop for today's show. We've got experts here who can answer your questions and give us context for these events. We also have two quick check-in calls from organizations that have been affected by this warm winter, the Iditarod and all the high school kids here who ski race for their schools and have trouble finding a place to ski. We'll hear about how those groups are coping. So let's get started. Our guests in the studio are climatologist Brian Bretschneider. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Brian's third trip back. Thank you for being such a stalwart for us. And National Weather Service meteorologist Louise Foti. Welcome, Louise.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And this is your first time.
It is my first time on the show.
Yeah. So welcome and thank you for taking the time out to do it. You can think of these guys as your resources. They know a lot. I've just been listening to them pre-show, and boy, do they know a lot. So you can call with your questions at 550-8433. Statewide, you can call us at 1-888-353-5752. And we can take an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. So I do want to just touch quickly on how this became your life. Brian, let's start with you. Why did weather and climate, I mean, you're completely absorbed.
Well, I think a lot of people, you're outside, you observe the weather and you find it interesting and you want to learn more about it. And I had the opportunity to learn more about it in school. And
you mean, is it like elementary?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it's something that I decided to pursue academically, and I studied, and I got my PhD in environmental geography, but the focus in climatology. Mm-hmm. And I just find it endlessly fascinating. You know, some people find gardening or cars or whatever fascinating, and I find it. I find looking at the weather and climate data to be.
So there was no pivotal moment in sixth grade or anything like that?
Actually, probably there was when I first saw the Weather Channel. We didn't have cable, but a family member of mine had cable, and I saw the Weather Channel.
And you were mesmerized.
And I was pretty mesmerized by it.
And so, how old were you?
Probably about 14.
See, it just can happen. And mm-hmm. How about you, Louise? How did meteorology become your field?
Well, I kind of have a similar story. I think a lot of weather people do, actually. I was we did a weather unit in class when I was in sixth grade, and I thought, you know, this is pretty cool. And at the time, I actually wanted to be an archaeologist. But then in seventh grade, I had to do a project, and I chose meteorology for my school project. And I checked out these books from the library, and I thought, you know, I think this is what I want to do. And that was it.
And so I wanted you to throw that out there, because I think when people are listening, you're so advanced in your fields now, but there was a day when you were just starting out, and that could be true for anybody. This could become a field. And I imagine it's a growth industry for given the climate change issues that we're going to have. This is probably a good field for people to think about. So there's that. Well, I'd actually like to welcome Holly Morris on the show. We invited a couple folks in the community to let us know how they're coping with this weird weather. If you looked at our website, you saw Brian ice skating on his street right in front of his house on January 2nd. And so I was thinking, who does that impact? Well, I thought it probably impacted skiers. So I contacted the Anchorage School District to find out, well, how are they doing? And so Holly Morris, hello, Holly.
Hi.
Thank you for joining us. I got to you because my husband goes to Kincaid all the time, and right after the snow, he was there, the snow we had a few weeks ago, it was just packed with kids skiing, and it was it almost had the feeling to him of this pent up need to ski or something. So I called you. You're an activities principal at Diamond, is that right?
Correct.
And one of your jobs is to get the kids out skiing and competing. So you've had some challenges this winter. Why don't you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, unfortunately, we had to cancel the first race in December because of the lack of snow, and the high humidity level made it impossible for the wonderful folks with the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage to make snow. Because while the temperatures were cold, if they were to make snow, it would become slush with that high humidity, then becoming ice.
Mm.
And so we finally, the following week, they were able to make enough snow, and there was a little bit of natural snow that we were able to hold a race in December, and we have not had to cancel since. A large part of the reason we haven't had to cancel are those great folks with the Nordic Ski Association who have amazing groomers that go out and have worked over what became ice into turning it up to being sort of snow-like. A little bit of natural white stuff that fused very well to their efforts. The Parks and Rec people accommodating our need to go back to Kincaid. And even a group such as the Arctic Winter Games Biathlon crew that adjusted their competition so that we could hold our race in the morning and not have to cancel.
Mm. So it's a precious commodity. A good ski trail is becoming a precious commodity. I think you told me that you haven't been able to ski over at the service trails. There's just been a lot of difficulty. Do the kids do something else when they're not able to ski? Do they run the trails, or how do they get ready anyway?
They'll do what we call dry land training because the land is dry without the snow, and so they'll do a lot of running.
Mm-hmm.
Some teams will hit the weight room, but there is simply a lot of conditioning work that's off of skis. Some programs do have roller skis, so before snow or ice sets in, they can use that to their advantage, which kids enjoy a little bit more than running.
I'm wondering about ice skating. Actually, when I think about, you know, skate skiing, it kind of mimics that ice skating, so maybe some of this ice has been an opportunity for them. And we're talking about hundreds of kids affected by this, right?
Correct. We have as many as 350 kids slated to ski a race on a given weekend.
Yeah, wow. And going forward, right now you're okay, but it's really hard to predict. I mean, you build up to these big championships and everything, just taking it week by week?
Pretty much. This weekend, the skiers have a weekend off, so to speak. There's no competition. Our next competition is the 30th, and it's back at Kincaid, scheduled to be there. So we're okay to have that loop as long as the weather cooperates and doesn't deteriorate it further. And then by February 13th, we're to ski at Russian Jack. So we're all hoping some natural white stuff appears so we can actually ski a trail other than Kincaid this season.
Wow. Do you go up on the hillside at all?
The hillside's been okay. The service trails, my understanding from the coach in the community up there, is they haven't been able to ski the trails, but they've been able to put the kids in the stadium a little bit. It's just hard to do distance when you're skiing.
Going around in a circle.
Exactly. It's more than, it's even less distance than what's referred to as the gerbil loop that we have up at Kincaid.
Right. Well, it's a challenging season and makes your job a little bit busier than it might have been, although it's probably pretty busy anyway. But we wish you luck. And I don't know if you guys have any questions for Holly or just want to wish her luck, too.
Actually, I was interested to know, how soon in advance do you have to make the decision whether to cancel a race or move it elsewhere?
We made a commitment with the coaches before the season began to know on Tuesdays before the race. And so I try to keep the district schedule, the online schedule, as updated as possible. And there are times that we determine that we're going to wait till Wednesday because we're hoping that the groomers can work some magic. Because on Tuesday they'll say, right now we would have to cancel, but tomorrow we may be able to do something different. And so then it's just communication with the coaches who then communicate to students and parents to let them know.
Hmm. Wow. How about you, Brian? Any questions?
I was just wondering how many miles or parts of a mile artificial snow that you can make man-made.
Oh, so you're talking about man-made snow in
right.
Kincaid. Yeah.
Right.
No, in terms of gallons of water, they're tons, actually, not gallons, but a few tons of water having been made into snow up there. And because it's fused so well with the natural snow, I'm not sure how far they go, but they the current loop is just under 2.5K.
Okay.
And they are hoping to expand it just a little bit so it can be a true 2.5K. It all depends on, with the blessing of the varied trail users being so cooperative and everyone shifting to try to have everyone's event occur in the same time frame or in the same day, then it gets a little bit tricky, and sometimes it's a little bit of a shorter course for the safety of folks.
Wow. I just, it sounds like something fundamental is changing when, you know, you're used to high school athletes out there on the ski trails and junior Nordic and all of that. And it's a real shift in the way people are behaving, at least for now. Like, I'm not going to predict it's going to continue. I we'll talk about that later when we talk about climate change. But anyway, Holly, I just wanted to say thank you. I thought it was a good example of how we're making adjustments here in the Anchorage Bowl to the strange weather that we're having. So I'm going to say thank you and return you to your busy day. Thanks so much for calling us, Holly.
Thanks for having me on.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So let's talk about some of the big influencers. I mean, the headline today, that we started the show with that. But I think, you know, let's give people some of the basics that why are we in Alaska experiencing interesting weather? But also we can get bigger than that. So El Nino or some of the things, the blob, what is it, the North Atlantic Oscillation, the polar vortex? What is the important thing for people to know?
Well, I'll go first, and as we've talked before the program, we're currently kind of probably just past the peak of one of the top one or two strongest El Nino events on record, and I think that's something that's in the news a lot.
What is the El Nino?
Well, the El Nino. An El Nino event is a warming of tropical Pacific waters around the equator. There's different El Nino zones, but approximately the central Pacific Ocean, southwest of Hawaii. And when periodically every 3 to 5 or 7 years, there's a switch in the trade winds, and that affects ocean currents and allows more warm water to well up. And then that has this cascading effect on the climate, really, of the globe. It adds heat to the system, but it also changes where the jet stream is, and it changes convective patterns and wind patterns and high and low pressure circulation. So it really has a large impact on global weather and temperatures.
It might be important for people to think that weather isn't local, it's global. I mean, you think, oh, we always get this at this time of year, but actually maybe not, because it's not isolated. Nothing is really isolated.
Well, even, you know, and a lot of people in the news today probably hearing about the potential crippling blizzard on the East Coast. And, you know, 2 days ago, that was a little wave ripple in just south of the Gulf of Alaska. And so, you know, something that happens here, then... you know,
are you saying that we have impacted that snowstorm? And I mean, well, not we, but
right.
What was happening near Alaska impacted?
Yeah, you know, it,
talk
it
about that.
Just what four? I think about a 4 day difference between when the initial circulation started to form south of the Gulf of Alaska, and now is working its way up toward the East Coast with, you know, feet of snow in D.C. possibly.
So that's amazing. So they're not getting our snow. That's another thing people like to say. You got our snow. That's not really true. I mean,
that snow
would have never landed here.
No. But even more, so El Nino really affects large areas, particularly with temperatures and atmospheric patterns. But there's a kind of more directly related to Alaska weather and climate is what goes on in the Pacific Ocean, kind of north and in northeast of there, in the you know, from maybe the Dateline westward, and then north, far north of Hawaii. And so maybe Louise can talk about that a little bit, but something that's been referred to as the blob.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, that was another one. We have a news story on the site that talks about it cooling, and I thought, you know, people read that, they don't know how to anticipate, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean we're not in as much trouble as we were? Or, you know, what does it mean that the temperatures are a little cooler? So to help us a little bit with the blob, Louise.
Well, I'd like to start by talking about El Nino a little bit.
Oh, sure.
One of the things I mentioned to you before the interview, before we went on the air, is that El Nino and weather patterns are really the way, the Earth's way of evening out
the heat across the Earth. So that's why we get these kind of different hot and cold spells, because they're all, the Earth is trying to even itself out, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to El Nino, there's really good scientific studies that show a strong correlation between what's happening with El Nino and what's happening in the lower 48. We don't have such strong correlations here in Alaska. So all this talk about El Nino, it's still not really known how it affects Alaska. The temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska seem to affect Alaska weather a lot more. We've had unusually warm temperatures for probably 2 or 3 years now in the Gulf of Alaska. It's significantly warmer. And so now the temperatures have started to cool a little bit. And this is, of course, what we were referring to as the blob. The temperatures have started to cool a little bit, but they're not back to normal. So we're still warmer than normal. We're not just super hot like we were before.
Hmm. So we really should be thinking about water temperatures and warm water as affecting Alaska weather more than the El Nino, although the El Nino affects the whole globe and that gets us too.
Right. And I'm sorry. Go.
Well, and the other thing I'd like to say is that it doesn't just affect our weather. It also affects our fisheries and the marine mammals that live out there. We're seeing a lot of unusual things in the environment right now due to these warmer temperatures. And it's all kind of interrelated. And we're not even sure as scientists how exactly these connections are made. But we know that something unusual is going on out there.
I saw one news account of what was going on with salmon trying to return into the British Columbia area. I think the Fraser River, something like that. They were swimming around the blob. So they were staying away from the warm water. And it was just something that they noted. They didn't know if it was bad for them, but they were choosing not to swim through that warm water. And I have no idea. We'd have to have a fisheries biologist on here to understand that.
Well, and there's a cyclical pattern of waxing and waning of temperatures in the Northeast Pacific over periods of decades called the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And it was actually kind of discovered, if you will, by fisheries biologists in the mid-90s who were studying salmon returns and looking at water temperatures and other environmental variables and kind of put some pieces together that there's this kind of 20 to 30 year cycle of temperature changes. It goes up and down within those 30 years, but very long wave pattern change that was affecting the fisheries. And now that's an important area of research for climatologists.
Interesting. I just want to sort of let folks know, if you've just joined us, we're really talking about weather and climate today based on the very strange winter we're having, the very icy New Year's Day we had. We just talked with Holly Morris at the Anchorage School District trying to get the kids out to ski. It's kind of hard to do that. The ski trails are somewhat of a commodity now, and they're being shared pretty cooperatively among the groups that are trying to reach them. In the studio, we have Brian Bretschneider, a climatologist, and Louise Foti, who is from the National Weather Service. And we are just going to talk about climate and weather. You know, tipped off the show with the New York Times headline today about 2015 being the hottest in historical times since 1880. I guess that's when they got their records going. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So it doesn't sound like it's a short-term thing. So why don't we go ahead and throw out our phone numbers for folks. You can give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752, or we would welcome an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. You know, Brian, before the show, we talked a little bit about people's memories and how mm-hmm. they don't actually remember the weather very well. Mm-hmm. And I sort of invite you to throw out a question. We'll see if people want to answer it, something related to the weather.
Well, and that is something I think we may have talked about before. You know, a lot of times people will say, oh, this is the most extreme since this, or this has never happened before, or yeah, I remember that cold winter of whatever year. And it's interesting from a social, psychological point of view that a lot of times people do misremember. So, we had a couple of big Chinook events earlier this winter. And, I heard a lot of people say, well, this is really unusual, or it's never really happened. You know, they don't remember it ever being this bad before. And so I just kind of maybe throw out there if what people's recollections are of Chinook events in Anchorage and how, do they remember stuff like this happening before?
You know, I used to live up on the hillside, and I can remember we earmarked January as the Chinook time, and you know the winds were battering, and it was incredible. But I can't be more specific than that. It's kind of like January, right? That's the Chinook season, right? Mm-hmm. Right after Christmas, we get a melt, and then it gets cold again, mm-hmm. and life is good. But
and then maybe another one is, you know, we went 10 days in a row without any snow on the ground here in January, and you know. Ask people what their experience is in January. Is that something they remember happening before?
All right. Well, so we're throwing that out there to listeners. You know, what Chinook events did we have early this fall? Is that what you're talking about, mm-hmm. Brent? Mm-hmm. And what was the second one?
The amount of snow that we have on the ground here in the middle of winter.
Okay. We'll just throw that out there and see if people want to jump in. And I'm going to welcome a caller on the show. Welcome, Jim. You're calling from Wasilla?
Yes.
What's on your mind?
I used to do a lot of backcountry skiing. I still have my original wood skis and boots from Gary King from 1972.
Wow.
3 feet of ski, 3 feet of snow to ski on, you know, most of the year. But now what I have to do is drive to Talkeetna, charter an aircraft, and fly up to the Ruth Glacier to do any skiing.
Wow.
Maybe sound like an exaggeration, but it's frustrating. And I remember in 1974, winter of December and January, it got 54 below zero in Anchorage. And then in 1976, it got 60 degrees in January. And that type of thing has never gone back to those cold temperatures.
I'm sorry, what was that second temperature you mentioned?
Say again?
Well, the second, you mentioned some really low temperature in the 70s, and then what was the second one you mentioned?
In January of 76, it got up to 60 degrees in January and melted most of the snow. Mm-hmm. There was still a lot of snow packed around, but it was melting fast, and it lasted that way for quite a while. But every year since that time, it has been longer and longer periods of these extreme warm temperatures.
Yeah.
And another interesting fact is I've worked north of the Brooks Range on the pipeline, and moose are now wintering north of the Brooks Range and surviving, and their calves, and they never used to. If they survived the winter north of the Brooks Range, they were barefoot. And now that's not the case. They are surviving up there.
Oh, wow.
There's more brush growing that they can feed on and hide in. So it's a changing environment. So those are observations that anybody can make around them. But I've got some really nice old military wood skis and some other wood skis. And I like the wax. I got that down to a fine science, and now I can't use it.
Well, I think you can sell those, you know, at an antique shop for hundreds of dollars now, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to part with them.
No, I'm sure
it's
you don't.
Sentimental. Actually, maybe people are starting to feel sentimental about winter also.
Yeah. As far as it being, I think he said minus 50s in the
70s?
In the earlier mid 70s.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps that might have been with the wind chill. I know, you know, officially in Anchorage, the lowest temperature ever is minus 38.
I understand that, but I see that 45 below in Mountain View, there was a huge storm blew through in the end of December of 1974 and tore up planes and stuff. I worked at the airport, and it tore up a lot of airplanes out there. And then after that huge storm went through, this big cold front came in behind it. And yeah, we didn't have a calibrated weather bill thermometer there at the fire station, but we watched the temperature because we had to deal with it out there, you know, with fire equipment in our lives and whatever else. So
that's
what I saw.
Okay, I'll look into that. But because there are some other stations around that have some, like Merrill Field and Elmendorf Air Force Base, or now J-Bear, but although the station's officially called Elmendorf Air Force Base. I'll look into it, but you know, those are certainly temperatures you would expect more in the interior.
Yeah. Well, Jim, you give voice to people's kind of reminiscences and sentimental feelings about how they've enjoyed Alaska growing up or years living here. So I appreciate your call. Thank you.
Oh, I'll have to use my motorcycle more.
Yes. I was thinking about, you know, when there's a downside for one group, there may be an upside for another group. And one of the other stories I read was golf courses on the East Coast, at least until the snowstorm that's coming, mm-hmm. I guess, they were having a great December, mm-hmm. where the mountain areas in that Northeast were not, you know. So
yeah, all the ski resorts up there were having a really hard time.
Yeah, and so when it gets good for one, it gets bad for another, or vice versa. So I don't know. I think the most interesting thing for me is how to get people's head around this. And so they, you know, unless you keep records, you know, and we were talking about people's memories, mm-hmm. you have a sort of a gross sense of what's been going on. But whether you can say it's getting worse or getting, mm-hmm. you know, and one of the things we talked about before the show was maybe it's less a concept of warm weather as weird weather because of all these influences. And would you guys agree with that?
Well, I think, and it's really, you know, sometimes specific events are what stick in your mind. It's hard to say, well, you know, in this month or this winter, yeah, I think the average temperature was this. You know, you remember a warm spell, or you remember a big snow, or right. you remember a flood or something like that.
So why the data keeping is so important, because you can go back and look and say, well, what really happened?
Right, exactly.
It is. I mean, there's been many times where I'll pull some data together and I'll show it to people and they're like, no, that's impossible. It's not what happened, because I remember what happened. But then you say, well, but this is what the data shows.
Yeah.
Like, well, I still don't believe it. And so it can be really hard to convince people, and so if you just rely on recollections, and recollections aren't always wrong, but if you rely solely on recollections and anecdotes and single observations, then you really lose out on a lot of the big picture, and it's hard to make, you know, policy decisions, and it's hard to plan, you know, for snow removal and or for road construction, for ski races, and it's hard to make decisions without that good high quality data.
Yeah. So. I don't know. I was thinking as we were talking, I have this image of the house we live in. We're over on the west side. I have two big wooden planters, you know, those barrels. And I can remember winters where you couldn't see the street at all. You know, the barrels were gone in the snow, deep in the snow, and you couldn't even see the street. And honestly, it hasn't been that way for 3 or 4 years. The barrels are out of the snow, of course, right now. You know, it's just crazy.
Now, I would like to, because this came up in a discussion I had with someone a few days ago, you know, as far as snowfall, at least here in Anchorage, there really hasn't been. I mean, we've had a couple of bad years in a row now, right?
So, yeah.
But you know, we had our record year before that. There's actually been.
I know, 2011, right?
Yeah, and it's actually, and even the year after that was like 96 inches of snow, and the normal 75. So,
right.
So you know, the even though temperatures are trending upward here in Anchorage and everywhere, that really hasn't translated yet into a demonstrably noticeable difference in at least the amount of snowpack and when it tends to set in here in Anchorage. So I do like to caution people that, you know, a couple of bad snowy winters in a row, you know, isn't necessarily, that's not part of a long-term trend that we can see.
Right. Certainly when you hit 2011, people might have thought, it's all over. Good news. Life is good.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a little break, but we do have Mark Nordman on the phone. He is the race director and race marshal. And when we come back from our break, he's going to update us on what they're thinking about for the Iditarod. So stay tuned. And you're listening to Hometown Alaska. This is Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy, and I'd just like to remind you we're talking about weird winter weather in Alaska and around the globe. We have Brian Bretschneider in the studio with me, an independent climatologist, and we have Louise Fode, warning coordination meteorologist. I wanted to get that. It sounds so ominous, warning coordination meteorologist, in the studio with us, and we've been taking your questions. But right now we're going to welcome Mark Nordman, from the Iditarod. This is the Iditarod race director and race marshal. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
I really appreciate you taking the time to give us a call. The Iditarod's been in the news just this morning. Just before we started the show, we were talking about a story we'd seen in the Fairbanks News Miner that was talking about, you know, maybe a Fairbanks start. And then Brian just said this morning when we were getting together, oh, I saw a story that it's back in Willow. So why don't you tell us what you know now? I know you can't call it, but what are you thinking about? What are you worrying about? And, you know, when might we know when you're really going to start? Where are you really going to start from?
Sure. Well, first off, it always surprises me how the media blitz about this time of year comes around where we're going to start, and that's a good thing for the state sport and definitely for Iditarod. You know, we've always had the intent of going over the Alaska Range. That's on the traditional trail. As was I was listening to your show a little earlier, it was, you know, a couple years ago we had a huge amount of snow, and 2014 we were light, and then last year it was deemed that there was no way we were going to put those dogs and teams over that rough trail. So it's been interesting for me this year because it's almost been regionalized. You know, we've got a lot of snow between Squintna and up to Rainy Pass, all the way to the top of the pass. Of course, anybody that's ever followed Iditarod has realized this Dalzell Gorge is always a concern. I flew over the taken reports from local travelers out in that area and stuff, and we're really good sitting on good snow. It's always light on snow on the other side of the range, but just in the last day I've taken reports that they've gotten another little dump there. So as of right now, as always, we're planning on going over the, you know, over the range, over the traditional trail.
Which means you'd be starting in Willow?
Yeah, we would, and we sure can use some more snow in Willow, but I think that that's something we can work with. It doesn't take a lot of snow running up the river. I know teams have been traveling up that way, and another race is actually heading up to Squintna this starting on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Would you pack in snow for those first couple of miles? Are you going to think about something sort of proactive like that?
You know, not at this point. I think, like I said, I think we're going to be fine getting off of Willow Lake. We can always use more, but we do have a little bit of time for that area to, I won't even say mend a little bit, because I think with the right amount of equipment and different work, as far as hauling in snow, I don't see it. I guess the thing that needs to be brought up, too, is, you know, of course, Anchorage. That's the big celebration of our event. And, you know, we're always looking at secondary plan B and C for that type of start, as we do with the regular official start on Sunday.
So are you thinking we might not start in downtown Anchorage, or?
Well, we'll make every effort to do that. Yeah, that's such a big thing for not only the fans of Iditarod, but, you know, sponsors, and we have an Iditarider program that has been so successful for us, and so we want to make sure that we have something in Anchorage there, and our intent right now there, again, is still to run from, right on 4th Avenue all the way over to Campbell Creek Science Center and BLM.
Mm-hmm. Right. And of course, you must be thinking long term. One of the discussions we had in here was the need to make a decision. You know, you can't wait till the very last minute. And I know I read in the paper that you have food drops that will be happening. That's probably forcing you to grapple with this now, even though people think, oh, we got weeks, you know, we could get a huge, you know, the timing for the decision is difficult. So it's looking like Willow, but what's your drop dead, you know, okay, you know, we assess the situation now and this is what we have to do. Is that February 12th?
It is, and that's all due to, as the media has reported, due to our competitors having to have their gear, and when we say food drops, that's dog food, of course, and all their equipment. That process takes place on the 17th and 18th in Anchorage, but we also have a food drop that where everybody drops everything off from the interior from the Fairbanks area, and that would be on the 15th. So what I want to do is be able to have them give the competitors a weekend to make sure their bags are, you know, packed properly, because there would be a change if we did bring the event to Fairbanks.
Right.
Now, if this year, and we're always looking at other options, but this year, if we weren't able to start in Willow, we would go up to the Fairbanks borough there and start somewhere in that area and then run the same route that we did last year. But as I said right off the bat, I think right now we're still still doing all right, but this has been a crazy weather year.
Yeah. I'm going to invite Brian and Louise to ask you any questions, but I have one more, which is,
sure.
You know, given that we started the show with the headline that 2015 was the warmest year on record for the globe since 1880, and, you know, are you taking it year to year, or do you have a long-term strategy? How do you think about it, you know, running the Iditarod in, you know, with the backdrop of climate change and just weird weather, if not warm weather, weird weather? Do you have a long-term strategy?
You know, I think the options that we've put out there for the competitors and the event itself and everybody that backs it is pretty much where we're at. You know, we have talked about something that hasn't been discussed much, but we met with a group of people from Minchumina yesterday, maybe do a, you know, on these years that we couldn't get over the Alaska Range, that it wasn't safe for the dogs. Maybe we try to go from Fairbanks, Nenana, Minchumina to Lida, Nikolai, and then on the way. So we have some other options, but we have that big hill on the horizon that we got to get over, and that's the Denali Range.
Right. And I know Brian made the point earlier that we've had great snow, and most of Alaska has had good snow this year. And you're seeing the same thing, Mark.
Yeah, we are. And I think that's what, you know, that's why people are so, you know, surprised when I say that I think we can run the traditional route, because we're looking out our backyard and seeing grass up till last week again. So
yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing, you know, and the coastal, we see things changing on the coast as far as snow coming. And then these, you know, not just that one Chinook in January, but, you know, I personally live up in Denali and we're used to 40 below for a week to 10 days at a time. And it's been balmy up there.
Wow. Well, I invite Brian or Louise to ask you a couple questions. Go ahead, Brian.
Well, the between Willow and Squintna, I know there's been a lot of talk about the rivers and a lot of open leads on rivers around the state. Do you see any problems with getting from Willow to Squintna with open leads on the rivers?
You know, I don't think we're going to have any problem with those leads, because we have had mushers that are running up there and training quite regularly. I just came back from the Kuskokwim 300 out in Bethel, and, you know, they had their challenges too and stuff with open leads and stuff. And so, and there is a race that's being run this weekend going all the way to Finger Lake. So I'm feeling pretty good about that. I will say that the river between Nikolai and McGrath, which every year we've traveled, is not safe for travel right now. There is a overland trail that we're looking at using. So, you know, we're adapting all the time, short-term and long-term.
That's interesting. How about you, Louise? Anything you want to ask?
Actually, Brian asked the question
I thought of.
Yeah, I was wondering about the river travel as well.
Great minds think alike, right?
Yeah.
Mark, I just want to ask you, do you want to leave our listeners with anything? I know you're a busy guy, and we're lucky to get you here, but you also sound very calm. For someone in the weeks leading up to the Iditarod, you sound so calm, I have to say.
Yeah, well, that's why I have a heavy-duty case on my iPhone, so when I throw it against the wall, it doesn't break. No, actually, you know, it's a process that I've done for a long time, and we've been through these situations before, and I've got great people around us, and the board of directors is into it, and so, you know, we'll make the right call on this, however it is, for the event and for the sport.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And we'll all maybe do a little snow dance for you later today. So
please
thank
do.
You, Mark.
I appreciate that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye. I can't get over how calm he sounded. That's half the battle, probably, just sounding confident that it's all going to be fine, and then cross your fingers for snow from...
And having a backup plan.
Yes. Yeah. You heard about a couple of good backup plans there. So, yeah, they are thinking long-term and short-term.
And it didn't come up, but I'm sure he's seen the one-month and the two-month extended outlooks, which all, you know, show above normal temperatures and, I think, below normal precipitation. So hopefully that doesn't mean what we have will melt, but...
Right. Might be icier.
But counting on more snow, you know, it's always an iffy proposition, and the long range forecasts aren't especially promising. But we'll keep our fingers crossed.
So adaptation seems to be one of the key words here. You know, everybody's got to adapt. I'm going to throw out our phone numbers one more time, and then we're going to go. We haven't had anyone swing in on the Chinook question or whatever the second one was. I forget. You too.
I might have forgotten to.
Okay. Well, here's our numbers. If you've got questions for these great meteorologists and a climatologist, please give us a call at 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. And actually, we did get an email from a gentleman who is asking a fundamental question. I think it's a good one for us to take on. We did touch on it at the beginning, but he's sort of saying he doesn't understand the difference between climate versus weather. He feels as if he doesn't understand what weather and what, and he'd just love to get it a little bit more grounding. And we did touch on it a little bit in the beginning, but why don't we go ahead and do it again?
That's a great question. We get asked that question a lot.
Yeah.
The way I like to talk about it is that climate is your average of what's happening. So a climatology is actually a 30-year period. That's kind of taking a look at the conditions over that long term. Weather is what's happening today or tomorrow or next week. And eventually, all of these weather events add up into your climatology because you're basically averaging the weather events. But when we talk about climate, we're looking at, you know, the conditions on the longer term.
Yeah.
And I think I mentioned last year, I think a good anecdote that I like to give to people is, you know, climate. Well, I think that there's a famous saying, climate is what you expect and weather is what you get. And the other one is you know, that weather is the clothes you put on any day, but climate is what you have in your closet.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think that's a really good analogy, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I famously last winter, Senator Inhofe from Oklahoma brought a snowball onto the floor of the U.S. Senate and said, you know, there's snow outside. You know, what global warming? But that really represents an excellent example of that represented the weather that day in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
and not the climate. And, mm-hmm. and a very common, you know, confusion of, oh, look, I'm looking outside and this is what the climate is. Well, if you look outside, you're looking at what the weather is generally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're looking at the mountains and where the tree line is, then you're looking at climate. But if you're looking at the clouds and is it cold today or is it warm today or cloudy? That's the weather.
Yeah. You know, we have another email, and this one, I don't exactly understand one part of it. It says, what long-term changes are happening to our history with the move of official Anchorage Station from Merrill to AIA? And is that Anchorage International Airport, AIA?
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like to take a stab at that first. That's actually something, a common question I get. So, Anchorage has been has collected data since 1917, climate data, daily weather observations. And it started at Ship Creek in downtown. And then in the 1930s, it moved to Merrill Field. And then in 1952, it moved to what's the Anchorage International Airport. And then in 1998, it moved to the Weather Service Forecast Office. And then...
Where is that?
That's off Sand Lake Road.
Okay, I've seen it. Yeah, okay,
Lake Road. And then in September of 2014, it moved back to the airport, although they were collecting data at the airport from 98 that whole time. So actually, all the temperatures that were collected at Sand Lake are actually not part of the official record anymore. But anyway, so the airport is by the water, right? It's by Kinnick Arm.
Right.
And so it has a little bit more of a moderating influence. From the water provides a little bit of heat.
Maritime. Uh-huh.
And Merrill Field is a little bit colder, and so because it's a little bit farther from the water, and so there's a lot of people kind of are concerned about that the climate, if you look at, has the temperature been rising or falling, is influenced by where the actual station is located, and
how do you cope with that?
Well, they coped with it in a kind of a really straightforward way, and that is, right now only data from Anchorage International Airport counts. All the other data is still being collected. Still kept.
Uh-huh.
It's still kept, and
you can download it. They didn't try to average or anything like that.
No. So weather records in Anchorage literally start now in 1952. And so there is no Merrill Field data is not part of the official climate data of Anchorage anymore.
Is that a loss? Is that a concern, Louise? What do you think? Is it just a fact?
It's one of those things that ideally we wouldn't be moving our climate stations around like that. But Anchorage is not the only place that this has happened. There are plenty of locations that have been moved around within
the
city
or
whatever.
Where the population is, or, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's part of the unfortunate part, I think, of as we learn more about the importance of siting and that sort of thing, keeping something in one place. But and don't forget that when we're talking about things like climate change, we're not just looking at individual stations and what's happening at that individual location. We're looking over a whole area, and we're incorporating a lot of other stations, and we're incorporating things like satellite data and sea surface temperature information. So climate change is an assessment of all of these things. It's not just the temperature at one individual location.
And actually, if you look at it over the course of a year, Merrill Field temperatures are very, very similar to Anchorage International Airport. It's a little bit colder at Merrill Field in the winter, but then it's a little bit warmer there in the summer. So on balance, I've looked at it before, it's something like less than a tenth of a degree Fahrenheit. So it's almost exactly the same. So it really no impact, even if you included it in the long-term records.
Yeah. We did get another email from Tom McCrane talking about, when we talked about it a little bit before the show because it came in yesterday. I had mentioned that Fairbanks had plenty of snow, and he sort of took me to task for that and said, well, not really. But in his email, he talks about some snowfalls in September that were hefty. He says the trails right now are getting a little icy. They've had some precipitation. So I don't think you guys were in disagreement. They had some snow, but they
had a lot. They had either their snowiest or second snowiest September on record, but then it all melted.
Right.
And so even though Fairbanks is now like 17 or 18 inches above normal for the season, In another respect, they're probably pretty flat, and then they've only had like an inch and three quarters or snow in the last 50 days, I think. So they're in quite the snow drought at the moment.
You know, and I think something similar happened at Anchorage as well. If I recall correctly, when I was looking at the snow statistics, it was all kind of front-loaded on the beginning of the season. And then we went through a really dry period in kind of the November-December timeframe where we really didn't get much in the way of snow, which wasn't a big deal until we had the Chinooks that melted everything.
Mm-hmm.
So overall, we're actually beating last year, so we're not going to set another record this year, which
of
is
low
good
snow.
News.
Uh-huh.
For a while there, where it was kind of dry, it was it was looking a little sparse.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then when you have, I think today our snow depth is 2 inches. You know, when you have 2 inches, it's really susceptible. You know, if we get a warm up,
it could
Chinook,
be gone. Yeah.
It'll be gone in a day.
It's gone under the trees, all the trees.
Yeah. Whereas if we had 12 or 13 inches of snow on the ground, you know, we could withstand.
Lose some.
We could withstand a 2 or 3 day Chinook and be fine.
But
with these low snow totals. Yeah. We went. December was like our fourth least snowiest December on record, I think.
Yeah.
January's not doing so hot either.
You know, one thing we talked about earlier, and I want to touch on them real quickly, and we do want to get to how people can get involved, because that's that. Now that it's happening to us, we might want to get more involved. But we talked about why was January so icy, and you said, let me talk about that. And the other thing we talked about was the Front Range here, the Chugach, looks scrubbed clean, except that there are some areas that actually have some snow. Could we touch on those two things? First, the ice.
Well, I just real briefly, maybe, and then Luis can maybe talk
please
about
jump
the snow.
Into,
but
yeah.
I think on December 30th, we had about a quarter inch of snow, and it was really wet snow. It was like 34-degree snow, high water content. But the roads were, even though we had been in a Chinook for a couple of days, the roads were well below freezing still. I mean, they're frozen at least a foot down or a foot and a half down. So they're a real reservoir of cold air. And so with the high water content, the water and it just the compression of it, it froze to the road. And then you get a few cars driving over it, and it really squeezed out all the air from the snow. It just stuck to the road.
And became ice.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, on main roads, it wasn't so bad.
Right.
Because, you know, cars driving by with the studded tires, they grind it up. And
it's the neighborhood.
Yeah. And it was still above freezing. So, the top layer of the ice was liquid. It was melting. And I like to give the example of, you know, if you pick up a wet ice cube versus a ice cube right out of your freezer, the wet ice cube is hard to hold on to. It slips out of your hand. Mm-hmm. And so we had above freezing temperatures. But we had the road still good and frozen, and so it was really kind of a perfect confluence. And then if you had the side streets that didn't have traffic on it, you know, the main streets, again, if the studded tires were grinding up the ice, and because it was wet, just the tires moving would kick it up on the underside,
yeah,
you know, and make all
yeah.
the cars dirty,
yeah,
kind of like a breakup.
It was amazing.
so right. the side
almost,
streets.
You're almost describing like a Zamboni effect.
I know,
here,
it
where
is.
they come out yeah. and they spray the water on the yeah. on the ice, and then it freezes into mm-hmm. this like perfect sheen for ice skaters.
Yeah.
And that's pretty
yeah.
much what happened on the side
right.
streets.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
So I was
right.
able just from my front door to skate. Down the street and onto the Campbell Creek Greenbelt Trail and skate down the trail to yeah. our local lake and then skate on the lake.
So. Was it, on your site, somebody posted a place where they actually ice the trail. The people are skating on the trails. In other words, they've taken their trails and... Was that you? I saw
yeah,
that just this
I
morning.
I did one where I skated on just the Campbell Creek Greenbelt Trail, but
yeah.
I don't know if anyone's
this was
doing
another
that lately.
Country where they were actually working on it and actually making it a thing. Let's talk about the Front Range. We still have about 10 minutes. We've got plenty of time to get to some, you know, volunteer opportunities and ways people can get engaged. But we were talking just at the start of the show about, you know, that looks like the Chugach has been scrubbed clean, but then we were talking about some places have more snow up there. And let's just talk a little bit about that and why that might be.
Well, you know, I think the Chugach Range is a really good example of how localized weather effects can be. And so we don't have much on the Front Range at the moment, but we've had a fair number of systems that have come in from the east and dropped a whole bunch of snow on the other side. So we've had some conversations here about how the snow in Turnagain Pass is actually pretty good. And I think you said the Arctic Valley opened early this
yeah,
year.
Yeah.
And I know Hatcher Pass also has had really good snow. So anytime you have a system coming in, it really is affected by those mountains and where it funnels the snow and whether the on the dry side you're not going to get as much precipitation. Maybe you get some wind that kind of melts away what's currently there. I think that's kind of what we're seeing on the Front Range
mm-hmm.
at the moment.
Mm-hmm. There have been some fairly scary avalanche events
in Hatcher.
Which, I mean, I know you guys are not avalanche experts, but you know, it has to do with a weak snowpack and then a sliding layer. I don't know whether it's continuing. People should check before they go out.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend that folks check the avalanche pages because anytime you get changing weather conditions, it can change your snowpack. So anytime you have a system coming through, whether it warms things up or whether it dumps more snow, all of a sudden the snowpack is going to be completely new and the avalanche conditions may be completely new as well.
And the Chugach National Forest has a avalanche advisory that they issue daily and even Hatcher's Pass has there's a Hatcher's Pass Avalanche Center.
Yeah.
I did see they did a post-accident report on the third fatality of the season that happened a few days ago, and they showed how weak the snow layer was, even though it was only about 18 inches thick where the accident happened. There was a really unstable faceted snow layer with a more packed layer on top of it, and it after just a couple of pats with their shovel, it all broke off. So it can be really dangerous in certain areas.
Yeah.
You know, that brings up a good point because I read that he was actually buried under 7 feet of snow. So
mm-hmm.
even though there wasn't much snow, you're talking about 18 inches. All of that accumulated buried mm-hmm. him under a great mm-hmm. amount. So the amount of snow at the top isn't necessarily, mm-hmm. A direct correlation to the avalanche danger. And people should really see what the experts have to say before going out and taking risks.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. I'm just going to throw our numbers out one more time, but then we're going to go directly to sort of the science. We've talked some about the science of weather forecasting, but there's ways for people to participate and contribute. So 550-8433 in Anchorage or 1-888-353-5752. Can we do computer modeling in a few sentences, or is that how big is that? How important is that? Is that National Weather Service information?
Well, yeah, sure. I can kind of cover it pretty quickly here. Basically, with weather forecasting, we're taking all that data that we have through automated systems, through satellite, radar, And we put it into what you referenced, the computer models. And we have a variety of those. But they will take what we call those initial conditions based on the data that we supply. And then we have supercomputers that use a variety of equations to run out these forecasts of what's going to happen. And in an ideal world, of course, they'd always be correct, or perhaps not an ideal world, because the fact that they're not correct means job security for folks like me and Brian. But, you know, they come up with these solutions, and then we base the forecast off that based on our experience and our meteorological knowledge that we've learned in school. One area that we actually have a big gap, of course, is that data, because we have these automated systems, but they're expensive and we can't put them everywhere. So an opportunity for citizens to become involved would to be a weather spotter. And we can use folks who don't necessarily have a weather station in their backyards, just letting us know about danger, how much snow they've gotten. That's really helpful for our forecasters to be able to know what's really going on out there. Mm-hmm. There are also more advanced programs like the co-op program, where folks take weather measurements every day at the same time. That's more of a commitment, but we have a number of committed folks who do that. And then there's networks like our COCO-ROS system, which collects precipitation and snowfall data around the country and puts that into a network for us to look at. So there's a number of ways that folks can be involved, and I will give you a link to post on your website.
We will add a link. I know, again, I was looking at Brian's site, and I saw these school children were gathered, and they were launching a weather balloon, and you happened to be there, apparently. Is that something you do? Is this a way to engage young people or children?
Yes, we launch the weather balloon every day. Actually, we launch it twice a day, although I think most people are not going to want to come by at 2 a.m. And we do have the opportunity, if folks want to see a balloon launch, we can schedule a tour. So I definitely encourage people to give us contact at the Weather Service.
I didn't know you did it. We do it several times a day then?
Twice a day.
Okay, yep. Twice a day.
Twice a day.
2 a.m. and 2 p.m.
Yeah, or 3 a.m. and 3 p.m. in daylight savings time. Okay. But yeah, that's an important way of collecting data that we have all over the country, but we're lucky to have a station here in Anchorage that people can go visit.
Well, we will add that in case people want to get engaged as a sort of, you know, routine thing or just an occasional thing. And I thought we should mention the Paris conference, because we're talking climate, and there was, I think there was a commitment not to let the globe get more than 2 degrees warmer or something like that.
Yeah. I know we just have a few minutes, but this was the conference that was in December in Paris, and I believe 190 countries participated. And there was an overall commitment to keep global temperature from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, which would be 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
And we're kind of already halfway there. We're already up to 1 degree Celsius. And so 2 degrees was the
form. Did you grab your throat? Was
that? Oh. No.
Like you were shocked.
No. 2 degrees is the formal goal, but I think the language is every effort to be made to keep it within 1.5 degrees, because there's a feeling that kind of, that might be a point of no return. So
that's scary. I'm sorry. I'm scared. All right. We just have just a tiny, about less than a minute. So I'd like to say, what would you like to leave people with, Brian?
Well, I'd like to leave people with, you know, the fact that you know, the difference between weather and climate, and to listen to your National Weather Service forecasters, because they really do a great job.
And how about a sentence from you, Louise? It's tight.
I'd just like to remind folks that with climate change, we don't know what to expect. So we ask them to take the initiative when watching the weather to make sure they're safe.
All right. So, gosh. That was great. I have to say thank you to our listeners and our callers. Thank you to Brian Brettschneider and Louise Foti, and our two call-in guests, Holly Morris and Mark Nordman, and of course, all our listeners and callers. Next week, Charles Warforth will be back as your host, talking about the best way to assess the performance and readiness of our school kids, with a special emphasis on high schoolers. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Eric Bork is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.